I mentioned it a moment ago, but Brendan Burgess has said that KBC mortgage holders should switch to another lender before their mortgage is acquired by Bank of Ireland. He is founder of AskAboutMoney.com. Good afternoon to you, Brendan.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
I would take what you've said if I was a KBC mortgage holder with, I guess, a bit of urgency.
Yes, I think you'll probably have about 6 months, but you know, it takes a bit of time to move your mortgage. So what happened today is that the Consumer Protection Commission, which is supposed to protect consumers, waved through the Bank of Ireland's acquisition of the mortgages from KBC who are leaving the market without any substantial conditions. And the extraordinary thing is that KBC was one of the cheapest lenders and Bank of Ireland is one of the most expensive lenders.
Yeah.
And Bank of Ireland tricks customers by giving them cash back up front and in exchange for a much higher mortgage rate. So now KBC, people chose KBC for low mortgage rates, and now they're going to find that they're with a high mortgage rate lender and they won't have had the benefit of cash back. So I'm suggesting to them that they should switch. The best deals at the moment are the two lenders, Avant and Finance Ireland, and that's what they should be looking at. I'm just very disappointed that the Consumer Protection Commission just didn't place any limits at all on Bank of Ireland, and it's very, very disappointing.
It was the CCPC that made this decision, and you note here they made no reference at all to Bank of Ireland's very high rate for existing customers, and then their practice at Bank of Ireland, you note here, of charging existing customers more than new customers, which will result in a huge increase in mortgage repayments for KBC customers when they, or if they do, move to BOI.
Yes, I mean, if like an example I give is, let's say you've got a €300,000 mortgage that you've fixed it for 3 years. The rate with KBC at the moment is 2.3%. With Bank of Ireland, it's 3%. Now, a lot of people think, percent, just that, you know, what's the difference between 2.3% and 3%? You know, they're quite low rates. The difference is €2,100 a year on a mortgage of €300,000. So over a period of 20 years, a KBC customer who doesn't do anything about it and moves to Bank of Ireland will pay about €25,000 more over a course of 20 years. Like, that's a lot of money. I mean, it's well worth the hassle of getting your payslips together and filling in a few application forms. And you know, you might face legal fees up front of about €1,500. But it's well worth doing. You'll save that money in the first year, and after that, you'll be saving a lot more.
Yeah, €2,100 each year. And then you note €24,757. That's in additional interest if there are 20 years remaining on the loan. You also note that your own submission to the Consumer Competition Protection Commission was ignored completely, is how you word it.
Yes, I thought that what they should do is, you know, there are a few suggestions I made. First of all, you know, what I really object to any institution, and Bank of Ireland is not the only one, that charges existing customers higher rates than new customers. My suggestion is that, I mean, that all banks should be told you must treat existing customers fairly, and if you cut the rates for new customers, you must cut them for existing customers. And I thought if Bank of Ireland agreed to introduce that across the board for all their customers, Bank of Ireland customers and KBC customers, well then, waive this through and let it go ahead. But they didn't choose to do that. The second thing I suggested was, well, Bank of Ireland pays 2% of the amount borrowed up front to new customers. So treat the KBC people as new customers and give them up front 2% of the mortgage balance. And that's to compensate them for the much higher interest rate they'll pay. And of course, that wasn't done. And my final little suggestion was, well, these customers should really switch at this stage. It'll cost them €1,500 to switch. It's not their fault that they have to switch. They chose a cheap lender and now they're being forced to move to a more expensive lender. So I said, give them the €1,500 legal fees so that they don't lose out by switching to another lender.
Brendan,
and again, completely ignored.
Obviously, with what we're after speaking about, that's people who are currently holding a mortgage. But while I have you here, we heard this news today that new mortgage customers now need significantly higher incomes to buy a home. This is analysis from the Banking and Payments Federation of Ireland. It's not much of a surprise to people, but when you break down the numbers, you will be surprised, because now people need, new mortgage seekers, that is, near €80,000 to purchase a home. So between €71,000 and €77,000. That was between 2019 and 2021. If you look at 2005, for example, €60,000 was needed. Is it a good time for anybody who is seeking a mortgage to follow through with that at the moment, Brendan?
Well, it's always very difficult to answer, is this a good time to buy a house? Because I do not know if house prices next year will be 20% higher or 20% lower. I'm not like one of those many experts who will be able to tell you with confidence.
And you know what? I've had many of those experts, Brendan, and they have actually come on and say and said, you know, economists do not get it right all the time.
Yeah.
So it's a guessing game at the end of the day.
But if you're in a position that you need a house for yourself and your partner or your family, and you have the deposit, and you can afford a house that meets your reasonable needs, then I think you should buy a house. But I wrote a piece in the Sunday Times on Sunday just gone, where I've said that, you know, a number of things that should be done to help first-time buyers. And like in Dublin, in Dundrum, Dunleary Rathdown Council is paying €800,000 to buy apartments for social housing. And I have said that they should be buying houses outside the most expensive areas, not in the most expensive areas. And I'm sure the same applies in your own area, that, you know, councils are building houses and buying houses in the most expensive areas. And of course, the councils have unlimited money, and the ordinary first-time buyer can't compete with that. The other thing is, which I don't know if your listeners know this, but if they buy a newly built home, the price is 13.5% higher due to VAT. They're also paying development levies, and they're paying social housing levies. All of these things could be done in the morning to bring down the price of newly built houses. Now, of course, you know, developers will get some of that, will take some of that as increased profits. But there are a number of things that the government could be doing, but the government has to face up to these issues and not just be at all stages be prioritising social housing. I want to see social housing built. I want to see it built by the local authorities, but I want to see it built where it's reasonably priced and not in the most expensive areas of the country.
Brendan, you first came on to talk to me this afternoon about KBC mortgage holders. You're telling them to wake up and switch to another lender before Bank of Ireland gets their hand on their mortgage. And just to go over that again, you mentioned two institutions, Avant and Finance Ireland. You say they have the best long-term and medium-term fixed rates at the moment.
Yes, there isn't much choice at the moment, but, you know, in the Irish mortgage market, and Irish mortgage rates are much higher than across the rest of the Eurozone for various reasons. But the two new entrants to the market, Avant and Finance Ireland, are where people, depending on their loan to value and that, but that's where they are most likely to get the best value.
Okay, I appreciate you taking the time this afternoon. That is the founder of Consumer Forum, AskAboutMoney.com, Brendan Burgess. And if I just go back to this Banking and Payments Federation analysis, it's according to the organisation's latest mortgage market profile report. So 13% of first-time buyer mortgages and 7% of mover purchase mortgages were backed by incomes of up to €60,000 last year. That's compared to 51% and 28% respectively in 2005. So that would be the Celtic Tiger era, 2005. If you look at the counties and the areas in the country, the report shows, no surprise, Dublin remains at the top of the mortgage markets with just over 30% of homes bought in the year to the end of December 2021. Cork coming in second place with 11.4%. 4%, then followed by Galway and Limerick. The highest median basic household incomes, monthly repayments, loan values and property values for first-time buyers or those building new homes were in County Wicklow, our neighbours over there. It found the study that 83% of home mortgage customers build or buy properties in the county where they live. We know on Kildare Today, we've covered that at the moment, people trying to get planning permission for local areas in the county. 81% of first-time buyers buy properties in their own county. However, Meath, Wicklow, Dublin and here in Kildare, borrowers made up 30 to 32% of first-time buyer mortgages and 17 to 24% of mover purchase mortgages on properties in those counties, including here in County Kildare, as I noted. Very interesting. Chambers Ireland yesterday strongly welcomed the proposed levies on vacancies. It was in reference or response to Minister for Housing Dara O'Brien's comments made yesterday. And the head of policy, Shane Keneally, said, in quotes, "The Chambers network strongly welcomes the Minister's proposals to increase the levies on vacant properties. Vacancies are a blight and a burden on local economies and communities." Joining me now is the Chief Executive of County Kildare Chamber, Alan Shine. How are you?
Good afternoon, Kira. Yeah, I'm very good. And you?
I am not too bad. Thank you very much. The blight and burden that these vacant properties have on local economies and communities. You, as the Chief Executive of County Kildare Chamber, what would you say about this county?
Yeah, I suppose in some parts of the county we're very lucky. There isn't that blight, but definitely in some towns and villages there is. There's a lot of derelict sites in some towns. Obviously, some towns are doing a lot better and will be more business parks around it and may have train stations and so forth, without naming towns here. But there is definitely towns that would have a lot of vacant sites and a lot of derelict sites and broken windows in them, and the fronts aren't painted and so forth. And it does just do not make the towns and villages look attractive when people are coming into them.
Do you think this is going to have a big impact on the situation if there was these proposed levies put in place?
Yeah, no, I do. You know, like it's a 3% levy that will be, and some people are commentating today that that might be actually increased. But we're looking at approximately a 3% levy will be imposed on the landowners. And then how that's collected is another, that'll be interesting to see how that's collected, because obviously a landowner can say, well, look, I have a to let sign on this vacant property and I'm actively looking to sell it or to lease it. So then the collection of it is another thing. But I think it will put pressure on people and on landowners to free up that space, because obviously we're in the middle of a domestic housing crisis and we have the Ukraine crisis as well. So there's a government that are faced there with a two-pronged approach to make sure that we do get these vacant sites occupied where possible. And there is a lot of grants available as well then to get people living back in the towns and in villages as well. So that'll be very welcomed. It'll be a good spin-off to the local economy if we do get these vacant sites let and people living in them.
And Alan, do you have much conversation from the general public or much conversation with the general public regarding derelict buildings in the county and what could possibly be done with them? I know it's not on the shoulders of County Kildare Chamber, but some people may turn to yourselves.
No, they would care. You know, like we represent over 400 companies, and in those companies there will be a lot of development companies and a lot of businesses that would own their own premises and may have other business or units in their portfolio as well. So we'd have a good knowledge and understanding of where these units are and what people are looking to do with them. You know, and we're engaged a lot actually at the moment with the SEAI in terms of looking at sustainable grants to retrofit buildings, you know, because your listeners will know that earlier on this year and late last year, these grants were made available for residential people that are looking to upgrade their own homes. Mm-hmm. But there is a serious lack of funding there to upgrade and retrofit commercial buildings. So we're engaging with government on that, and hopefully we'll get a good outcome with that in September time. But landowners, you know, the majority of landowners we engage with are looking to get their units occupied. Now, there is instances where developers would have land interests outside of the towns and villages, and they're looking to get zoning and require specific zoning for that land so that they can get what they would like to see happen on that land. So there's a good bit of engagement with Kildare County Council ongoing throughout the year, every year, with that. So we do represent businesses and business interests with the council. Some of the time it can be frustrating where the landowner may be looking for a specific zoning on that land which wouldn't comply with either the local area plan or the county development plan, and then that landowner might potentially sit on that land for a number of years and might wait for that local area plan to come around again, and then they'd start lobbying again. And so that does happen quite a bit. But then the council do have the power to put in a derelict site notice on that landowner as well. So it's not as cut and dry in some circumstances. But I think potentially, you know, when you look at your small towns and villages where there is derelict units that are there lying idle for a number of years, this levy is quite powerful.
I think a lot of people will be au fait with councillor, Social Democrat councillor of Naas, Bill Clear, doing a derelict commercial buildings review, I guess, of Naas in particular. He noted there is 55, this is back in April, may I say, 55 vacant and derelict commercial buildings there and 65 vacant and derelict houses. We know we're currently in a cost of living crisis. Many people, you know, finances is the top of their worries. As an economy, Kildare, that is, how are we bouncing back, per se, from the pandemic? How do you see things going, Alan?
I think Kildare has bucked the trend. I think Kildare, as an economy, as a county, has done very well over the last number of years. Apart, obviously, from tourism, hospitality, leisure and retail, but every other industry has been doing very well. We do very well, obviously, in manufacturing, warehousing, logistics and export. We're quite lucky in the county as well that there's only a small number of hotels that are family owned. So all those other hotels are well invested or they're part of chains as well. So that's, they've been able to manage themselves over the last few years quite easily. But I think the towns have done very well. And you can see that with there's a serious lack of supply of office space in Kildare. So the demand is there for office space. There's so many companies looking at the moment in Kildare to come into Kildare, and there's a serious lack of supply. So that shows you that, Kildare, obviously the strength is that we're so close to Dublin, to the airport and the ports, so that makes us a very attractive county to set up and do business in. And then obviously with Maynooth University and the flow of talent that comes out of that university, we're the fourth youngest population in Ireland as well. So we should be very proud of the county, and I think we're doing very well with huge job announcements recently up in Leixlip with Nikon and MGS, which are a classic manufacturing company. And there's a good few job announcements coming out in the next 4 to 6 weeks as well in Newbridge. So it's really positive, to be very honest with you, really positive at the moment. There's so much going on in the county. I think we bucked the trend. I think it's our proximity to Dublin definitely does help. You can see the Midlands County, I think we're the envy of them in many regards, like that we do have a lot of job announcements and high-end multinationals and large Irish-owned indigenous companies as well. And it's not just in the north of the county, it's down in the south of the county. So very good companies spread across the county. So it's been positive. It's been challenging, and obviously for the smaller businesses, high street, main street retailers as well have been suffering the last few years. But the majority pivoted as well. They went online. They looked at doing other things with their business as well. So it's been quite good, to be honest.
Yeah, challenging is definitely a nice way to put it, Alan. Mm. And of course, we'll have the ears open for the next 4 to 6 weeks to hear about those new jobs in Naas and Newbridge, two of the biggest towns, or maybe the two biggest towns in this county.
Some say Selbridge, Ciara.
Some may, but they're wrong. It's Newbridge.
Population wise, but look, every town is doing well, and we're here to support every town and village as well. And you'll see that today in our submission. It's the deadline day for the development plan as well for Kildare County Council. So it's everyone's, there's a few hours left. If people want to get their word in, in terms of what they want.
Alan Shine, Chief Executive of County Kildare Chamber. thank you very much for joining me. As we know, County Kildare Chamber is under the umbrella of Chambers Ireland, and they have strongly welcomed the proposed levies on vacancies. Now, in about 2.5 weeks' time, the Leaving Cert is back, and Irish Times columnist and guidance counsellor, one of many hats he wears, Brian Mooney, is on the line. Hello, Brian.
I am, yes, just having run out of John Storrs to take your call. But anyway, we'll go with it.
Okay, well, we greatly appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're having some tech issues here this afternoon, Brian. So just over 2 weeks to go. The 8th of June, English Paper 1 is what the students will be looking at first. You have a guide of do's and don'ts on what to do in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I have in the Times today. We did a piece which just looked at students. So look at everything from a five-week perspective now, right? In other words, work everything back from the last exam. Forget about the fact that the first paper, English Paper 1, is in 2 weeks' time. Look at the structure of your entire exam process and reflect upon what you can do over that period of time. In other words, if your last paper is 3 days after your second last paper, forget about it at the moment. Don't even go near it. Because effectively, when you've everything else finished, you'll have 3 days in its entirety with nothing else to do for that last paper. So be strategic in relation to your planning. And most of you will be finished school by now. You'll be at home. And structure your day. You know, get up at the normal time you would normally have got up with. And structure your day. Now, obviously, one's brain can only absorb so much information and can only literally work for a period of a couple of hours before you begin to literally have a very, very less productive session. So you need to take a break. You need to get nutrition into you. You need to get, you know, fresh air into your lungs. You need to get out and about. So you should plan your day so that, you know, do a good session in the morning, take a break around 11, come back in then maybe 12 to 2, take another break for an hour or two, maybe do late afternoon, and maybe one more session in the evening. That way, every session becomes productive. You're working through the past papers. You're looking at all of the papers that, you know, have been there before. Obviously, you have an easier time this year because obviously with the revised schedule for the Leaving Cert, students have more time, they have more choice. So effectively, don't get stressed about this. Now, if you're not stressed at all, there's something really to be worried about. But if the stress levels start to really build, then go and seek medical support. Go to your GP.
Yes.
But I mean, anxiety drives adrenaline, and it's good that you should feel nervous because that's going to really pump you up for the next 5 weeks and really get the best out of you.
Yeah, and it's also good to note there's a difference between nervousness and feeling nervous and anxiety. And I'm just going to give out, because you said that there, Brian, I'm just going to give these out, these numbers. So Samaritans is 116123. The Samaritans in Kildare and Newbridge, the number there is 045-435-299. Away 1800 80 48 48, Childline 1800 666 666, and then a mental health support text service, so you can text your worries to 50808. That's always very important. Keep that in mind. It's said all the time, but reach out if you are struggling, and especially at a time
absolutely.
Like this.
I would completely concur with that. I mean, adrenaline is obviously in any competitive
process. It helps
process,
us in a way, yeah.
It helps us. But I mean, if it gets to the point, but you can do simple little things yourself. If you find the anxiety is becoming, you know, it's disrupting your work, sit down, put your 2 feet on the ground comfortably, and close your eyes, take a deep breath in through your nose till your lungs are absolutely full, and then very slowly let it out and focus exclusively on the breath itself. If there's stuff coming into your head, let it come through, let it pass through, and go back to focus on the breath. If you do that for 4 or 5 minutes, you will find that your body calms down, becomes more relaxed, and enables you to get back. It's a very simple process, and you can do it all on your own. You can go somewhere private in the house and just, you know, bring down those beats, because you're in control. That's the issue. You are in control here. And once you learn to exercise that control, then you will find to be able to manage that anxiety. But as you say, if it becomes out of control for you, do go and seek support from all of those very, very useful organisations that you've just given the numbers for.
Brian, if I go back to your tips here of do's and don'ts,
yes.
This is something I definitely could have used when I was doing my Leaving Cert. Don't go into more detail than needed. You kind of feel like, oh, I'm going to put everything I know into the page. But 4 or 5 key points is what you
note. Because that gives you a sense of satisfaction, because you're writing on stuff you know. But at the end of the day, this is a competition. If you think of it like egg cups, you know what I mean? You have to fill 5 egg cups for each question. There's no point in pouring when it's all flowing all over the place. Once you have the egg cup full, go on to the next egg cup. If you've got a question and you know that basically the examiner is going to look for 5 points clearly outlined, once you've outlined it, there's no more marks to be got. Go on to the next point. So effectively, and another tip I would use is in the exam process, your brain has a massive capacity beyond anything that you can ever imagine. So use it fully. So when you start the exam, reflect on the questions you selected to do if you have choice, and start noting down at the back of the answer book, roughly, just the key points, those key points for each question. You're not going to be able to remember them all. But pick the one that you feel you're most comfortable with and then go back to start with that question. As you're doing that, and you know this happens, all the other stuff starts popping into your head. So flick back to the back, write down the word that has just occurred to you. And obviously when you finish one question, allow a bit of gap, a space, so that if you have other things that occur to you, you can drop them in. You're not going to be charged for the paper. So that by the time you get to the exam, and as any good journalist knows, when you have finished, if you have time, reread everything you've written, because as you're rereading it, all the stuff will occur to you, and you can drop that in at the bottom of the question. Everything you write on the paper will be counted. And if you do it that way, you won't be walking home and suddenly something hits you. Oh, God, I wish I'd remembered that when I was in the exam. Because if you start that process at the beginning and allow your brain to reflect on all of the questions, you'll probably find that by the time you finish, you'll have emptied out everything that you know about those questions. Because the truth is that at the end of the day, two people with an identical amount of information can get a radically different result based on how they actually process that data in the exam centre.
Now, Brian, one of these other tips I think is really key. Don't focus all your effort into your weak areas while letting others slide. That's what we tend to do, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, we tend to look at the areas that we feel that we don't, and, you know the information out, and then we get anxious and distressed. At the end of the day, you know, every paper, there is potential there. You know, even a half question is better than no question. At the end of the day, you know, in the exam. But between now and the 5 weeks' time, there is so much you can do by simply go back over the past questions, go back over the answering schemes for previous papers. And at the end of the day, there are opportunities. And one thing I would say to you is that when we're talking in August about the outcome of this, no matter what you get, so long as you're happy that you've done your best, there are routes into every single career that you could ever imagine, either directly through the CAO, indirectly through further education, opportunities outside of Ireland in European universities where they have never even heard of the point system, so long as you get your two H5s and four passes. There are huge opportunities to achieve your dreams, your ambitions. What you need to do now is bank the best result you can and then see where you're going to use that to get what you really want to do. And I'm saying to anybody out there, if you have a dream, I can assure you there's a way to achieve it.
Oh, well, that's a really good way to finish us up. Thank you so much, Brian Mooney. It's so true. I mean, it was said to me when I was doing my Leaving Cert, 10 years ago I did my Leaving Cert? And I think it's because you're all at the same stage and you all want to, you know, go to your college course in the same year, and you feel like you're left behind if you're somebody who repeats or you're somebody who has to take a year out. But really, there's a reason why everybody says it. It all works out. And if you want some more advice from Brian, very sound advice, he is writing in the Irish Times. And this headline for the discussion we just had is 2 weeks to go, the do's and don'ts of the run-up to the Leaving Cert. If managed properly, he notes, you can still boost your potential grade performance. So only good and positive news there. Now, a new class of anti-Alzheimer's drugs is capable of stopping or even reversing the devastating form of dementia. And this is possible thanks to breakthrough research, which is by a UCD-based scientist. That is Professor David O'Connell. He's Associate Professor at the School of Biomolecular and Biomedical Science at UCD. Good afternoon to you, David.
Good afternoon, Cheryl. How are you?
I am fine, thank you very much. It's incredibly interesting. I was reading about it yesterday. You've noted here that some think that if you can design the right drugs, this is a direct quote from you, people could be taking them from their 30s forwards, as dementia is a very slow-moving disease.
So this is something that has been studied by a number of groups who are, I suppose, specialists in the area of how dementia happens at the cellular level, at the molecular level. And so one of the things we do know is that the toxic process occurring in the cell is where proteins begin to disassemble and then start to stick to each other. So they lose their normal function and then they start sticking together. And that can be something that goes forwards and backwards for many years. but will gradually start to accumulate as kind of almost like junk protein, which is toxic to the cell, and the cell will eventually die. So it has been identified that this can be taking place for many years before any kind of outward symptoms take place.
David, can this might this? I know this. I'm obviously not au fait with this area, but does that not technically happen to every human brain on a much smaller level if you're not diagnosed, obviously, with dementia as they age? No.
It's a great question. I mean, there are actually a specific cohort of Alzheimer's patients who have what's known as the Swedish mutation. Their genetic predisposition to it is well characterized, but they're a very small subset of the kind of spontaneous Alzheimer's that we're more familiar with in the general population. So we don't know, you know, when people are healthy all the way to expiry, essentially, we don't know what's going on really in their cells.
Hypothetically, when would these people in their 30s be potentially taking this medication each day? If we're going to go and look at the usual science timeline when it comes to drugs like this?
Well, I suppose that the primary focus right now is to develop treatments that will be effective for sufferers. So basically people with mild cognitive impairment all the way through to people with dementia full. So, you know, as you know, you can have early onset Alzheimer's, which is terribly upsetting for all involved. For the general population, you know, we might be looking well down the line where things may even be an additive in the food that are something like a clinical ingredient in food.
Wow.
For people who are potentially family history, etc. But that's very forward-looking. Right now, I guess the focus of what we're talking about are molecules that can be effective drug inhibitors of people with a known disease, you know?
That is so interesting. So at least 50 million people are believed to be living with Alzheimer's or some type of dementia. This is globally. And it's noted in this article in the Irish Independent, major pharmaceutical companies have invested heavily in finding new medicines. But up to now, most candidate drugs have failed clinical trials. And again, you note very few companies are willing to spend billions on developing an Alzheimer's drug since most molecules fail in the clinic. So I'm sure that's the key barrier in this research.
It's a huge problem. So in cancer and in inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis or colitis, they are a huge pharmaceutical business because the medicines developed there, many of which are antibodies, are very effective. They're disease modifying. They improve the lives of patients. In Alzheimer's, there's been a terrible attrition where companies have spent billions and their drug molecules have ultimately failed in populations of patients, large populations. So much so, you know, very large corporations like Pfizer, for example, have stepped out of developing drugs in this area. So it is an area where even with the best...
Sorry, stepped out, David, because it's just not financially beneficial to them.
It's not financially beneficial. Okay. They've spent a lot of money on drugs that have been...
That have failed, exactly. Okay.
So, you know, when you bring a drug all the way through phase three trials, you're already looking at least $1 billion spend, you know?
Yeah, we've learned a lot more about that over the past 2 years, obviously, when it comes to the vaccines, you know, just how much money, etc., than we probably would have ever before.
Which has shown us what's possible. So
yeah, absolutely.
One thing that's good to take from that is that with the right push, the right accelerated push, things can be done much faster. And I think one thing we would be hoping for this type of drug and ones like it, would be for accelerated approvals upon showing the right indicators.
So you noted the drugs we have are either not targeting the correct molecules or they're not acting in the correct places in the brain. They're those currently. You've also noted there's a 10-year, often you say, a 10-year window of degradation where you don't even realise the person has it. And this means something to you personally because you note in this article that your own dad had Alzheimer's and you word it as a very debilitating and awful situation.
Yeah, and so many families that listen to your programme, you know, will be either in it right now or maybe about to go into it or maybe it's already in the past for them. And the real sad part is that the brilliant person you know and love, who's, you know, full of life and all the things you admire growing up, is still there, but it starts getting broken up. And so things become more fragmented, behaviours become completely altered, memories and, you know, general reactions all change. And so if, for example, a typical situation a mum is at home with the dad, the kids have gone off, you know, that person can start changing, and the mum might have to deal with that for many years before it's clear that something has to be done medically.
Now, you mentioned this 10-year window. In your own personal experience, did you note that with your father?
Yeah, we did as a family, for certain. Thankfully, I am blessed with great brothers and sisters who really, you know, toed the line at home with Dad, you know, who, as I say, was having kind of fantastic thoughts and fantastic behaviours to go with it, you know, trying to leave the house to board a train across the road, you know, to completely imaginary things, but very, very stressful. My mother, as I say, though, before having to engage all the brothers and sisters, would have had to deal with this in a more subtle way over a much longer period of time.
Yeah. And if there are people listening, David, at the moment, and they're seeing things in a subtle way, maybe the potential patient themselves wants to avoid reality and they're not willing, I guess, to go to any sort of health professional and get guidance. What's the best route, in your opinion, and what your family has been through, they can go down to encourage those to actually seek for help, or seek help, I should say?
I suppose the thing we learned as a family is that you have to, I mean, because, you know, not all families get on brilliantly, especially when you're in your 30s and 40s, you might have moved apart from each other. Actually, for us, it brought us all together. There was a clear discussion had. And actually, in a strange way, the legacy of it is that we're much, much closer now as brothers and sisters than we were before it. And I think, you know, without giving any advice to people that you wouldn't want to condescend anyone, but people have to come together. They've got to make very tough choices. You know, they've got to divide labour between them. And of course, your GP has to be very helpful, involved in opening up doors. But the main thing is not to leave somebody at home alone with somebody who's clearly changing, you know.
What was your dad's name, David?
Bill O'Connell. He was an amazing man. He was a graduate of UCC. He did his degree off Gaeilge. He got a scholarship to UCC. Oscar Elga, and did botany in college, and he was known as Botany Bill by all his friends.
Well, I mean, what not only amazing, but what a really lovely legacy to have, to say that, you know, through his struggle, his family became tighter knit after that. That literally brings a tear to my eye. I think that's so lovely, David. And
Thank you
yourself, with the work you do now, I'm sure you were heavily influenced by your dad's struggle.
I am, but I'm also blessed that I've been working with Sara Linsa, who is a professor at Lund University in Sweden, who's just extraordinary. And together we've been working with Pietro Salmani in Cambridge University, who, again, much younger guy, but is extraordinary also. So as a team, we've had wonderful strengths, compatible strengths. We've been able to bring different things to the equation. And yeah, it's wonderful to have, of course, a personal spur as well, you know.
Well, it was really lovely speaking to you this afternoon. You are, of course, Professor David O'Connell, Associate Professor at the School of Biomolecular and Biomedical Science at UCD. And may we pay respects to your dad, Bill O'Connell, or Botany Bill, as David called him, leaving an amazing legacy behind. You know, his family are now tighter knit than ever before. Very sad for any family to go through dementia or the loss of a loved one through dementia. And this new class of anti-Alzheimer's drugs, which is capable of stopping or even reversing the devastating form of dementia, is possible thanks to the breakthrough research by UCD-based scientists, and that is Professor David O'Connell. Thank you so much.